It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 19th of September. Good morning. This is Today with Justin Webb and John Humphreys.
The headlines this morning. David Cameron has revealed that he asked Buckingham Palace for support. And some vintage reporting from the BBC's archive.
The double-deckers had hardly left the dockside in New Jersey before facing their first minor problem. Manhattan is an island, and the logical way to get there would have been through a tunnel. But the tunnel is too low, so the buses had to go the long way around.
Oh, his famous grasp of technical detail there. What became of that chap? It's his last Today programme. He will interrupt several politicians, and we will interrupt him, or try to. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
David Cameron has revealed for the first time that he sought...
6 minutes past six, and Sarah Keith-Lucas is at the Weather Centre. Morning, Sarah.
Good morning to you, John. Well, today, after a rather fresh start to the day, we are...
Finally, I'd like to say a few words about John Humphreys. I've been privileged to work with John for all of his 32 years on the programme. First thing I want to say is, John, I'm surprised you're giving up, because I thought you were actually just getting the hang of the job.
Well... You had a point.
I'm often asked by our listeners, what's John Humphreys like? And I can honestly say, John, you're the sort of person that if I lent you $2,000 or $3,000 and I didn't see you again for 3 or 4 years, it would be money well spent.
Seriously, right, well, think about that one.
Seriously, it's been a pleasure working with you. I shall miss our breakfast chats at 5:15. We're out in the green room. Yeah. We're like the two old guys in the Muppets putting the world
to right. Speak for yourself. Yeah.
John, you've been an outstanding presenter on the Today programme, one of Britain's great broadcasters. Very well done, John.
Thank you, Gary. It's
well done.
I realise there are two people in this room, actually, who've retired too early. Sam
Warburton and... Well, he hasn't gone yet, Gary.
He hasn't gone yet, Gary. No, OK.
Not yet.
You've been here longer than me.
Yes, 6 years.
Quite. 6 years longer, not six years in total. You've been here for 106
years. No, 6 years longer.
Yeah, exactly. Now, our sister programme, Beyond Today.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
28 minutes to eight. When I joined the BBC half a century ago, political broadcasting was entering a new age. There were no cameras in the Commons, and interviews with politicians were extremely polite, if not deferential. Then people like Robin Day and Alastair Burnett came along, and it all changed. And now it seems it may be changing again. Not because we have decided it should, but because they have, or at least some pretty important figures have. Jeremy Corbyn's not been interviewed on this programme for nearly 3 years. Boris Johnson hasn't done a single interview with us since he became Prime Minister. It took David Cameron more than 3 years to face the microphone after he resigned. And that's just here. Did someone mention Donald Trump and Twitter? Increasingly, politicians are talking directly to the people via social media so they can choose the questions they answer without being challenged. But does it matter? We like to claim we are vital defenders of democracy, but in a changing world, is our way really the only way? I've been talking about that to a man who can probably claim to have suffered more at the hands of broadcasters than any other, Tony Blair. He entered Downing Street in 1997 to great applause. He left it 10 years later as perhaps the most reviled Prime Minister in modern history. If anyone can prove the old adage that when you're a politician, they're either at your feet or at your throat, it is him. So I wondered what he makes of the dawn of this new age.
The politicians that tend to rise to the top are those with very simple messages, which don't require a lot of explanation. But you should, as a politician, be able to defend those in a, what I would call a deep interview, rather than just in a snatched bit of Twitter feed or a headline.
Ah, so therefore the Today interview matters.
The Today interview should matter. I mean, I hope it matters. I still think it does, by the way, because I think there's an audience out there for a deeper dive into issues and an explanation and hearing both sides. Now you have this splintering effect where there are conversations going on all over the place, and that leads to two things. It leads to hard to have a proper dialogue, and also it allows people to put a point of view across that may be quite an extreme point of view, but they can create a kind of echo chamber for it and start to roll out from that base through into larger segments of the population, but not really on the basis of what I would call a deep debate.
So when somebody like Boris Johnson refuses to appear on this programme, either during the leadership campaign or at any time since he became Prime Minister, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that he thinks that he can get away without coming on it, which is itself a statement. Since when I again first began as a politician, you know, your ambition was to get on the Today programme. But secondly, it probably means that he is anxious about a sustained and forensic analysis of what he's trying to do. I mean, I think that is the explanation for it. Otherwise, you'd come on.
Our critics would say, do say, that the problem with the Today programme interview, for instance, or others like it, obviously, is that it's too confrontational, it's too argumentative, we interrupt too much, it's too much of a shouting match, our objective is to do the politician down and put ourselves on a pedestal.
Yeah, they said that about you, John.
Well, I don't think I'm the only target.
No, but you, look, you, let us say, honed the quite rebarbative form of interviewing. However, having said that...
I'm a secret of truth.
No, I actually, despite all the tussles we've had over the years, I respect the fact that you're good at your job and you're on top of the facts. And, you know, the fact that I worry about doing an interview with you is a tribute to you, not a criticism. But sometimes interviewers can be too aggressive. Sometimes the interviewees can just kind of do a dead bat on everything that's coming down the wicket at them. And that's kind of boring for the viewer. But the nature of the detailed interview is, I think, an important part of a political debate, because propositions should be tested and people should be expected to make arguments. This is a crucial part of debate, by the way, about democracy today, because unless you can restore some sense that politics is a reasoned debate between people who can agree to disagree, vote a different way, but not hate each other, we've got a real challenge with democracy.
You've did about 20 interviews on this programme, many of them with me, when you were Prime Minister. Did you usually leave the interview feeling that did my policies a bit of good or whatever? Or did you think, bloody hell, that was a bit of an eye, a waste of time, damaging ever?
Waste of time, not. Sometimes you come up thinking, well, I didn't really get a chance to put my case across, or I got tripped up. And sometimes you come across thinking, no, I said what I wanted to say. But I never thought it was a waste of time. Even if it was difficult, it was still valuable. And here's the other really curious thing. I don't mean to go back over all the referendum stuff, but the referendum is a different type of democracy, isn't it? It's a sort of direct democracy. And there's, I think, a feeling amongst a lot of people that this is a purer form of democracy than a parliamentary democracy. But politics, at one level, it's like any other profession. If you spend your life thinking about it, working on it and studying it, you'll probably know more about politics than someone who doesn't. In any other walk of life, we'd say that's natural. In politics, we describe that as elitist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a conversation the other day with someone who, when I was explaining about the single market, a customs union, all this, and he finally said to me in a sort of exasperated way, well, you're just trying to pretend that you know more about this than I do. And I said, look, I was Prime Minister for 10 years. If I don't know more about this than you do, I mean, there's something wrong. It doesn't make me smarter than you. It just means I've spent my life studying it. And we now regard the authentic voice of politics as coming from the street, when in reality, it's got to be a relationship.
I can remember, probably more clearly than any other interview I did with you, the morning after the Chilcot report was published, and at the risk of making this sound too personal, you seemed to me to be seriously tortured in a way that I'd not seen you before. You're under enormous strain. How could you not be after a devastating report like that? But I suppose really what I'm saying is, what was going through your mind during that half hour? Because it was a very, very intense half hour, it seemed to me anyway.
Yeah, it was. Well, of course, it was a very big moment. And you know, these are very big and difficult decisions. I mean, I think a way of putting the second part of your question is, you want to explain to people. Because politics at a retail level is very simple.
By retail level, when you give us your vote because I will do X, Y,
and
Z.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, when I was running for office, you had a pledge card with a five thing.
Oh, yes, gonna, indeed.
All of that.
John Prescott rather liked that.
Right. So at a retail level, it's often very simple. But when you come to decision making, it's really very complicated. Again, leaving aside the rights and wrongs of it, this is the problem with Brexit. It's a simple instruction to give via referendum. It's an extremely complicated to do when you start to study the detail. But in the end, if you've got a parliamentary democracy, there's got to be some appreciation of the fact you send people to Parliament And then they take decisions. If you don't like those decisions, you kick them out afterwards. But if you substitute for that a sort of direct conveyor belt between your instant thought one day and what government does the next, you can end up in a mess, which is where we are, by the way.
What about legacy and how conscious prime ministers are of their legacy? And it's interesting, isn't it, that you will leave a certain legacy. Inevitably, it's going to be tainted by the Iraq war. David Cameron will leave a certain legacy. Inevitably, it will be tainted by the referendum. Different sorts of crises, but massive crises for the nation nonetheless. How conscious are you of your legacy?
You are conscious of it, but you're most focused on trying to get the decision right. And, you know, look, I didn't then and don't now spend a lot of time thinking about legacy, because I think these things sort themselves out over time. And
really, frankly, but you must. I mean, it's been many years since the Iraq invasion, for instance, and you are known as the man who took us to war.
Yeah, but I mean, I know with respect you want to say literally that's the only thing people remember, but there
are
a lot of other things
too. But you wouldn't argue for a moment that overshadows everything.
I wouldn't argue that's a big part of it, and what happens there in the Middle East over time will determine, I think, the wisdom or otherwise the decision. That's true, but that's not you can't think about legacy when you're taking a decision like that, and I don't.
One's bound to wonder whether you don't look back at your career, as David Cameron has now just been doing at his, and say, I wish I'd done that differently.
Yeah, no, of course you can and you do, but you can't alter it. I say to people about, for example, the Iraq decision, I mean, I will explain the reasons for it and have done many, many times, and, you know, I've done countless interviews about it. There's only one thing that I say to people that they should accept, even if they disagree with it, that I took it in good faith. And knew, by the way, that at the time it would be extremely difficult. And I don't doubt, actually, in relation to the referendum decision, that David Cameron took it the same reasons. He actually believed it was necessary to do it. Now, I might not agree with that, but to conduct politics in the sense of the political leader is acting in bad faith when they take a decision you disagree with, that's part of the problem of politics, because people can do things in good faith that you disagree with.
So is this going to destroy the two-party system? Or is the two-party system fatally flawed anyway?
I think what would destroy the two-party system is if it becomes clear that the two main parties have moved so far away from the centre that the gap in the centre has to be filled in order to be representative of the state of opinion. You will get a new political grouping of force emerging that could challenge one of the two main parties.
And maybe the country needs it.
I think if the two parties stick where they are, the country will need it, yes. One of the things that troubles me most about politics today is I can't tell you the number of smart young people, and it's partly because my oldest kids are of this age, in their 20s and 30s, really intelligent young people, politically committed. A, they've got no home, and B, they look at the state of the two main parties and say, I couldn't join either of them. And it doesn't matter what I say, what anyone else says. You only have to look at the Liberal Democrats now at their party conference. You know, for the first time in a long time, they're looking at a much more serious group of people. Why is that? Because people have come from the Labour Party, come from the Conservative Party, and they've got a coherent argument. If I was the two main parties at the moment, I would worry a lot about that.
But not an argument you agree with?
Well, it's an argument I agree with. I'm very tribally and deeply attached to the Labour Party. But if over a long period of time, someone from outside your political party is making an argument you think is more sensible, it starts to pull you in the opposite direction.
Ah.
Yeah, so, but anyway, I mean, I'm
Does
not...
that suggest that you might at some point?
No, you shouldn't read that into it. It just suggests a deep level of frustration about where the Labour Party is and, you know, where the Conservative Party's gone to.
Tony Blair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for all the interviews over the years.
I'm hesitating now to whether to say it was a pleasure. It was often a pleasure. It was occasionally not a pleasure, but it was always worthwhile.
Thank you very much.
The first of the ex-Prime Ministers John is talking to this morning. We'll have another one at 10 past 8, just like buses, aren't they? 16 minutes to 8 now. Time for a look at the papers. Photos of Boris Johnson being confronted by the father of a serious...
And it's been revealed that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, the ultimate adverts for refusing to slow down in your 70s, have an unlikely passion, which isn't particularly rock and roll. They're both big fans of Downton Abbey. According to The Express, Sir Mick has been known to cut short Rolling Stones rehearsal so he and Keith can get home in time to watch it on the telly. And now, at 13 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. And with us this morning is Rabbi Lord Sacks, or to give him his real name, because he's an old friend of this programme. And welcome to you, Jonathan.
Thank you, John. Good morning. Among the contributions of Judaism to the world were the prophets of ancient Israel.
In the next hour on this programme, we'll be talking to David Cameron. Not any old conversation, though. John will be talking to him. It is, of course, John's last day, and we will be extraordinarily nice about him too, in a desperate hope that he doesn't write nasty things about us later in the Daily Mail.
Heaven forfend. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and John Humphreys. Matt McGrath reporting there. The time is 10 past 8. It's 3.5 years since this country voted to leave the European Union. In 42 days, we finally leave. Maybe. We can't even be sure of that. The fact is, we are still in an almighty mess. And the man responsible, the man whose autobiography, For the Record, is being published today, is sitting opposite me. It was David Cameron who called the referendum. And this is what he told me the day before the nation voted.
I would accept the instructions of the British people and get to work on Friday morning to deliver them.
Mr. Cameron, good morning.
Good morning.
That was a false promise, wasn't it? You misled the nation.
Well, first of all, can I just take a moment and say thank you for 32 years of striking the fear into politicians like me every morning and asking us questions that we don't always want to answer and calling us to account. It's an amazing record. Badgett talked about the dignified and the efficient parts of the Constitution. He didn't tell us about the painful but necessary parts, and I guess that's where you come in. The truth is, I came to feel towards the end of the campaign that I had so thrown myself into one side of the argument that I would lack any credibility if we voted to Brexit to be the person to deliver that. I came to see, and even more on the night itself, that the country needed a new prime minister, that I wasn't the right person to take the country forward because of, you know, the way I'd been so much on one side of the argument. And I think that was the right thing to do.
But why
I hated leaving the job that I loved, serving the country I loved. It was miserable to have to do that, but I just felt I wouldn't be able to do the job properly.
But why, hours before we were to turn out to vote, why did you say, I will accept the instructions of the British people and get to work to deliver them?
Well, at no point did I want people to go to the polls thinking that the referendum was a vote about my future. I think, frankly, if people had thought, right, let's... never mind Brexit, let's just get rid of the Tory Prime Minister, I think the result probably would have been even worse. So I think it was right during the referendum to say this is about in or out of Europe, it's not about me. But as I'm saying to you very frankly, and I try and be frank in this book, towards the end of the campaign, I could see that as I was so much on one side of the argument, I'd thrown myself, I'd given everything I had. I was on the battle lines arguing we should stay in a reformed Europe, and if the country voted the other way, we would need someone new to take things forward. I didn't want to resign so quickly. Obviously, I was expecting a three-month Conservative leadership election. I thought, as I put it outside Downing Street, I'd be able to steady things and explain what I thought needed to happen next. But what was going to be 3 months suddenly just became a few days and left this impression that somehow I'd hurried away, which I hated giving that impression, and I was miserable about leaving the job that I loved.
Except that you said in the book, I was certain about what I needed to do next if we were to lose. You were certain a long time ahead of the interview that you gave to me, saying that you were going to stay and carry out the British people's instructions. I don't know when you decided,
I think in the book I explain I became more certain as the campaign continued. I remember meeting with George Osborne sometime before at home, and we talked it all through, and At that stage, I was still thinking about what could be achieved. So we've taken a different path. But I say this, frankly, you know, we are the sixth biggest economy in the world. We're choosing to be friends, neighbours and partners of the European Union rather than members. And we can make that work.
David Cameron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The time, 29 minutes to nine. We are throwing everything up in the air this morning. No sport, Gary's too emotional. No weather, though it's probably fine, but cloudier up north because it often is like that. The Director General has just walked in, which is often a sign that we've libelled someone, but hopefully possibly is attached to John's last day. But we can have a summary of the news now from Jane Steele.
David Cameron has told this programme that it had been a terrible mistake to say that the Queen...
Here it is now, 27 minutes to nine. When I started working at the brand new television centre all those years ago, there was a young trainee called Tony Hall, very much my junior, when I started presenting the 9 o'clock news. He's done rather well for himself since then. He's Lord Hall now.
Who are you, John?
Well, I'm not Lord Humphrey. He is Lord Hall now, and he is the boss. He's the Director General, no less. Things have changed a bit since then, Tony.
They have,
or the BBC.
They have changed a lot, but there are some fundamental things which are the same from when you and I worked together on the 9 o'clock news all that time ago.
You were my junior.
I of course was your junior.
And you didn't get drunk.
Always in your service, John.
But I just want to make this point, just yes. for the record, that most sub-editors went off to the bar when the 6 o'clock news ended and came back to the 9 o'clock news. I'm rather the worse for wear. You didn't. So there you go. I think you and I
obviously set standards there and so on. No, look, there's so much which is the same as when you and I started off. At that point it was about film and you kind of wrote today's story to the film of yesterday with cardboard graphics and all of that. But frankly, the search for what's going on, what is the truth, is exactly the same. And that's what you've spent your career doing here on this programme. And it's very interesting hearing the president of Microsoft talking about that this morning. You know, finding the ways in which we can engage people through interviews, through our journalism, in the stories that matter, is the common thread that's run straight the way through both our careers. And the fact is, I think now, I'm optimistic. I think there are more ways in which we can engage people with the debates that matter, the stories that matter, than when you and I were in the television centre many centuries ago.
But it is it's a massive... But we're fighting a war against social media and all sorts of different platforms now that didn't even exist then. And you yourself have conceded it is possible that by the time the next charter comes up for grabs, we will have to have some sort of subscription model for the BBC. In other words, the licence fee may die.
Well, let me tell you that there's two really, really big questions in that. I mean, one is, I'm seeing, in fact, your guest this morning, the president of Microsoft, after this, because I think the fight against misinformation, fake news, call it what you will, is one of the biggest struggles we've got. And we've got together, the BBC's got together as a convener, a number of social media companies, plus some other journalistic organisations, to work together to make sure that in the next election, wherever it happens to be, here or in the US, we work together to identify and call out fake news. We work together on education programmes.
That's
and this is really, really important. Now, on the other question about subscription, what I said was... The BBC is more important now and is going to be more important in the next decade than ever before.
But it is possible that we will not win this battle.
And we will win the battle because what you get from the licence fee, this is the bit that, of course, never gets quoted, what you get from the licence fee is something I profoundly believe in, which is something that the BBC has for everybody. World Cup football, women's football, for everybody. We bring the nation together. Information that people believe
you
in.
You know what's happening to our audience.
And
you know what the challenges are.
Oh, I know. Oh, God, we all know what the challenges are. And I think we're going to win those challenges too. But I actually think there's something about... I think the world is changing. There's something about saying that that we pay for something together to give a real benefit to everyone, whether you're rich, poor, in the Orkneys or Cornwall. I think that principle is really important. And I think that principle is not changing.
And if you're an old age pensioner who is worried about having to pay for the licence, what do you have to say to them?
That's a decision that the board and myself have been through. We've come to a conclusion, which is we want to help the poorest by saying those on pension credit will continue to have a free licence after June of next year.
But that is a form of means testing.
It's a hard decision. Yes, it is a form of means testing. It's a hard decision, but what we've done is to follow... the government's line on where poverty for old age pensioners begins. They've determined that. We've followed that. And in the decision that the government asked us to make, that was all in law, we've tried to do a balance between the security of the programme and the content of the BBC, and on the other hand, a realisation that for some people over 75, paying the licence fee is hard.
And it's not going to change. I mean, that is set in stone. Nothing will happen.
That's what the board have decided.
That's what the board decided. Tony Hall. Lord Hall.
Before I go, can I just ask, say two things about you, though?
Oh.
One is...
too late, you can't sack me now.
No, I know that.
You're going to mess up
our
timings,
I've got 18 minutes, but never mind. I just want to say a big thank you to you on behalf of all of us, the people who've loved working with you, the people who've put up with you at times too. A very, very big thank you. And I also want to say, in all the stuff that you read in the papers about the Rottweiler Humphreys and all of that stuff, you are also someone who handles interviews with people who have been through traumas or disasters or have something they want to get off their chest, but they don't know how to do it, with amazing sensitivity. And I don't know whether that goes back to Aberfan and being the first person on the... does it? Is it back to Aberfan and being first there?
They all play a part, don't they, I suppose, in the way you behave. But anyway, that's very kind of you, Tony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
On that subject, funny you should have brought it up, because some broadcasters do change the way we do things. You think of Robin Day, you think of Brian Walden, you think of the trailblazing of Sue McGregor, and of course you think of John, and you think of the splash that he has made down the years.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire.
It's as if Jerry Lee Lewis knew what was happening. That was his hit the year John left school, 1958, aged 15. He wanted to be a reporter, he wanted to be in the thick of it, and a little over a decade later, he was.
Well, we haven't been here for more than 7 or 8 minutes at this airfield, and in that time there have been 3 strikes. This is the third one coming over now. There's the big guns fire. There's a saber just gone overhead. And that's how close they came to hitting us. I suppose not more than 15 or maybe 20 yards away.
The Indo-Pakistan War of 1971. Humphreys at the scene, as he was again and again around the world and closer to home in Northern Ireland.
The army expected trouble and they got it. At least 120 shots were fired at the soldiers. 8 of their men were hurt, 4 of them with gunshot wounds, and were taken to hospital.
John was our man in Washington, the youngest ever, when Watergate broke. In 1972, he caught up with Bob Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff. It was just a doorstep, as we call them. Poor Mr. Haldeman was trying to get into his car, but this was John, and he didn't make it easy.
John Humphreys, BBC London. May I just ask you, sir, how all this has been affecting work in the White House?
Well, there's been, of course, some attention that had to be put against it, but I don't think it's seriously affected work at all.
And can I ask you about your personal plans for the next few days, sir? Are you going to appear before the grand jury?
I haven't any idea. I'm willing and anxious to appear whenever they're ready to talk to me.
What about the conversation you had with the president?
I wouldn't discuss any conversation with the president.
But you're still saying that you were absolutely nowhere involved with the Watergate affair?
That's correct.
Can I just ask you why you think all these reports have gained so much credence?
I think I'd have to ask you that. I don't know.
Wherever John went in the world, a lot seemed to happen. Cause or effect, who knows? Here he is in Southern Africa at another moment of huge change.
15 minutes after the results were announced, a column of military vehicles rolled past Mr. Mugabe's house in what used to be a white suburb. The soldiers looked sullen, in contrast to their new Prime Minister, who came out into his garden to talk to some of us.
We've been seeing a lot of troops in the city, and indeed a lot of armoured vehicles went past your house just a moment ago. Are you at all concerned that there might be some sort of white backlash? Or...
No, I don't think so at all. I had discussions yesterday with the service chiefs. Our commitment to peace is total.
By now, John was popping up all over the world. At a time of mass TV audiences, he was becoming a household name.
First, the news with John Humphreys.
1981, household status is solidified. A proper reporter reading the news to 10 million Britons. He says he was nervous on his first day, frozen with fear.
A defeat for the top men at the TUC. The members tell them, change the rules. 2 Northern Ireland policemen have been killed in a landmine ambush. And the ambush on journalists in Angola by South African warplanes.
But he was soon bored.
And in 1986, he got a call from the then editor of Today. Did he want a change? He did. In 1987, he started. This was his first programme.
It's 7:10. As you heard in the news, there are growing suspicions that that hotel fire in Puerto Rico was started deliberately.
Soon he was into his element and he invented the Humphreys approach, the energy, the probing. And Today, which had rather sauntered through the morning's news, became the place to be and the place to be heard.
Big news, Mr. Gorbachev will not be coming to Britain because of the earthquake in Armenia. We have on the telephone now from 10 Downing Street, Mrs. Thatcher, who I gather has just heard the news, Prime Minister.
Hello, good morning. I heard it on your news briefing. It was the first indication we've had, but of course we understand. When there's a tragedy like that, Mr. Gorbachev has to go home. And then I heard later that you didn't know whether I'd heard, so I thought I'd better let you know I had.
Well, thank you for calling us.
Down the years, they all came on.
Sir John Major is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
I'm with Mr. Blair now at his home in London. Good morning.
Good morning.
The Prime Minister is with me. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Prime Minister.
Good morning, John.
Mrs. May is with me. Good morning, Prime Minister.
Good morning, John.
And, of course, sometimes the politicians regretted it.
When will we be out of the European Union?
We formally leave the membership.
I know when we formally leave
the membership.
Given what you've just been saying, extending transition.
No, we leave the membership of the European Union on the 29th of March, 2019.
Phrase, your very first six words, I will be with you whatever.
Yes,
that is a total commitment to do whatever the United States wanted to do. In other words, go to war, and we would go with him.
I've made it very, very clear. The IRA...
Sorry, let me finish.
You're not answering the question.
No, John.
I'm asking you whether there should be any more bombs in British shopping centres. Why can you not say, no, there shouldn't?
Well, it's no good trying to get us all to be nasty to each other, because I don't believe we are. And at least you'll have to admit, I've got a debate going.
Well, you certainly... I hope that
last interview with Ken Clark, who was Chancellor at the time, led to complaints that John was poisoning the well of democratic debate. Those complaints have come and gone down the years, as have the politicians, who have occasionally boycotted the programme, but in the end have always come back for more. John does interrupt, but his great skill isn't that. It's listening to what is said, as George Entwistle, the beleaguered Director General of the BBC, discovered on a Saturday morning in 2012.
There's nobody said to you at any time, look, we've got this film going out on Newsnight that is going to make massively serious allegations. Nobody even mentioned, in the context that we now understand, nobody even mentioned it.
No.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Well, in the light of what's happened here, I wish this had been referred to me, but it wasn't.
That interview cost George Entwistle his job. John has the capacity to damage people, but he also has the capacity to give people their voice and to take their case to those in power. As with Danielle Davis, mother of six-year-old Sophia, who needed cannabis oil to treat her epilepsy.
Her first day back at school resulted in a 9-minute seizure, and the school took the decision to ring an ambulance, but Sophia desperately needs the THC and time is of the essence.
And you mean that if she does not have this treatment, in your view, she could die?
If Sophia doesn't have this and her seizures continue, we could be visiting a headstone, and that is, it's something no parent wants to think, that their child will die before them.
John had listened. And Jeremy Hunt, then Health Secretary, was forced to listen too.
While politicians sit around and chat about these things and civil servants try to find another form or whatever, children are suffering. And I'm sorry if I sound emotional about this, but you're a father. You surely can understand that sometimes you have to do something that breaks all the rules and says, damn it, we're going to do it. This oil is clearly helping children. You could announce it tomorrow if Theresa May let you.
Well, we will do something. We'll do it as quickly as we can.
When?
I'm afraid I can't do it. I can't tell you that right
this
morning.
You're the Health Secretary. But why is it a Home Office matter? Why on earth is it a Home Office? It's a medical matter. You're the Health Secretary.
John is not a Rottweiler. That's the wrong dog. John's a terrier. He just keeps on. But he's also imbued this programme with humanity because he is keeping on with a cause. He likes people. Some of his finest work has been about people, as with his coverage of the 40th anniversary of Abervan. He was the first reporter on the scene on the day the disaster had happened.
It crushed part of the school and some tiny terraced houses alongside, like concrete dropping on a matchbox. And what that filthy mixture didn't flatten, it filled.
classrooms choked with the stuff until the building was covered and the school became a tomb. The moment the awful news reached them, the miners abandoned the coal face of the colliery, which had created that monstrous tip, and raced to the surface. And there they were, when I arrived, their faces still black, save for the streaks of white from the sweat and the tears as they dug and prayed and wept. They were digging, of course, for their own children.
John has been used often as a reporter on Today, not chasing politicians, but charming people into telling their stories, big moments made human.
Here in the black South African township of Soweto, the sun has now climbed higher into a cloudless blue sky, warming the shoulders of the hundreds upon hundreds of black men and women in a queue which stretches out of sight of the entrance to this polling station. Now, I said there's a lady standing in front of me, and you have just voted. You've been in and you've cast your vote, the first in your life.
Yes, and to make it special, I've just voted with somebody in my womb.
Somebody in your womb?
Yes.
So two of you voted.
The two of us voted.
Life is going to be very different for your son or daughter to what it has been so far for you, isn't it?
Actually, I know it's a son, so...
You know it's a son. Oh, well, congratulations.
Maybe, who knows, he must be a president. He'll be the future president of this country.
The next black president of South
yes.
Africa.
John is Welsh, in case you didn't know. He doesn't often talk about it, but when he does reveal his Welshness, it can be magical, as it was with Kerris Matthews, on a day marking 100 years since Dylan Thomas was born.
Mr. and Mrs. Cherry Owen, sit down to last night's supper of onions boiled in their overcoats and broth of spuds and bacon rind and leeks and bones.
Remember last night? In you reeled my boy, as drunk as a deacon, with a big wet bucket and a fish frail full of stout, and who looked at me and who said, "God has come home," you said, and then over the bucket you went sprawling and bawling, and the floor was all flagons and eels.
Was I wounded?
And then you took off your trousers and you said, "Does anybody want to fight? Oh, you old baboon.
Give us a kiss."
And then you sang Bread of Heaven, tenor and bass.
I always sing Bread of Heaven.
And then you did a little dance on the table.
And then?
And then I got you into bed and you breathed all night like a brewery.
Well, where do we start? Where do we start? All the other presenters, some from, well, I won't say yesteryear, but some recent past presenters. Everyone's here in the studio, John. I got to ask you, before we turn to them, though, I mentioned in that piece that you did all those other jobs, and then you came here and you stayed rather a long time. Now, why?
What else was there to go to? I mean, there isn't anything. After the Today programme, there is no... I say this as... Well, I'm leaving the Today programme, but after the Today programme, there really isn't anything. You've got... Come on. You're where it is... You've got 3 hours to tell the world what's going on, to talk to all the most powerful people in the world and the most interesting and amusing and entertaining and sometimes sad and desperate people in the world. Why would you want to do anything else?
Are you an interrupter? I mean,
yeah,
by nature.
Of course I am. Yeah. Well, but I'm an arguer. Yes, yeah. I like arguing. I love arguing. Got it from my father, I suppose. But yes, of course I love it.
Yeah,
but look, if you
don't see,
interrupt...
Hang on a second, I'm going to interrupt you. But
no,
you argue. You argue from 4 o'clock in the morning when you first get in with everyone. And we're looking at the packed gallery with everyone who's ever worked with you here, and they're all nodding.
Yeah. It's all their fault. I mean, I just come in quietly, expecting a nice quiet morning. I congratulate the overnight editor on what a splendid job she's done, and then these other people come in and they start making trouble. I don't. If they just left it to me, I mean, if they just left it to the editor, it'd be fine. That's my view.
Anyone got an argument with that?
Literally
Nick?
Lost for words.
Literally lost.
You've never said that before, Nick.
Very true.
The annoying thing is that he is often right in the things that.
Hang on,
he
I'm just
out.
Writing that down. Yeah. Oh, it's too late now. You should have said that earlier.
I mean, there have been times you've even taken, you know, a script off my desk and even questioned my grammar. And annoyingly, you were often right.
But
on
I'm going to interrupt
well.
To point to Sue,
Sarah.
Who's sitting beside me, because you have got the most wonderful thing here.
Oh,
well,
gosh.
I tell you what it is, John.
Oh, what?
It's do you remember? Do you still talk about PSBs?
PSBs,
yes.
Programmes as broadcast. Yes.
Well, a clever producer on Current Today has found our first appearance together. Your first appearance on Today was with me.
I know it was.
And it was on the 2nd of January 1987.
Yes.
And I noticed one of the items, mostly done by males in those days, of course, was called Celebrating Age campaign launched today by Age Concern to promote the theme that old age can be fun. And I have to say, I've got my own notes on the PSB. In those days, no computers. We all
no, exactly. Typed,
I've got a photograph at home of you destroying the last Remington in the office, I remember.
Well,
you were looking very
cross. Was he throwing it at you?
No, but that's lovely.
It seems there is a bit of a myth about me throwing it out of the window. I didn't actually throw it out of the window.
Did he ever throw it? Did he throw the typewriter or not, Sue McGregor? We have to hear from Sue.
Let me put it to you that you destroyed a typewriter. Yes. Did you or did you
well,
not
I
destroy
it? Well, I may have been
property.
A little small incident involving it, but I did not throw it out of the window. We were on the third floor in those days in Broadcasting House, weren't we? And the idea of throwing it out of the window, I could have killed somebody.
The point is...
And there were lots of people I'd prefer to kill.
All right, enough, everyone, enough.
It needs to be said that John was using a typewriter after everyone...
That's
true.
Now, look, because none of you can keep to time, because none of you can keep to time, we have recorded some things, which we will play now.
It is an extraordinary experience sitting next to John in the studio. He's never still. He's filled with restless energy, writhing with it. And he's so engaged with everybody that he talks to. He listens to everything going out on the programme. He's created a radio programme around him through sheer force of personality.
I still remember being astonished at his energy levels. So much time, passion, commitment to whatever stories. And I think it made me realise that you set your own limits on whether you're tired of something or you're not going to read more. And he sort of showed me, you know, really, you can just keep going. He's like one of those little bunnies with the long life batteries. He just keeps going on something.
It's not exactly a state secret that John can be just a tad grouchy. But John's never bored. He never doesn't care. Every single morning, every single programme, every single item, he thinks matters. And he can be as grouchy as he likes because of that.
I've learnt so much from seeing what he picks up on, what he questions, how he deals with the many subjects that we deal with over the course of the programme. And ultimately, everyone around him ends up raising their game.
I have learned that he is far warmer, far more sensitive, far softer than I think people realise. Infuriating as well, of course. Bloody annoying.
At 5:13 a.m., never 5:12, never 5:14, the drawer of his desk is opened. The same bowl is brought out, and precisely the same amount of muesli is measured out each and every day. That's the measure of the man.
I once mentioned seeing a picture of a young John Humphreys, and he immediately said, younger John Humphreys, which is the way he prefers to see it. But ultimately, when he does pick up something in a script, annoyingly, he's usually right.
He enjoys his reputation for being behind the times, computers, bar humbug and so on. But actually, in some respects, he was far ahead of his time on the environment, food, waste, living, if you can believe it, a fairly frugal life. Inside 70s man is a very 21st century man. And after 21 years sitting alongside John, you might think, I'd be glad to be away from the daily grind. But here we go. I miss him.
Sue, you're allowed to say something live because you weren't in that tape, but also, crucially, because you will keep to time.
Well, you might not be right about that. But, John, I remember on that first day, which was the 2nd of January 1987, we were together, you were quite nervous about going from television and reading the news and coming to radio.
Absolutely terrified.
What was terrifying about radio?
Well, because when you do television news, you have a nice little script which you had time to prepare during the course of the day. It's on an auto cue, and you sit there and you read it. And you come in here, and it's not like that at all. I remember, in fact, Brian Redhead, one of the first days I was on, I looked, came into the studio and said, where are the scripts? And he said, the scripts are there. You've written them yourself. Bring them in yourself. Yeah, this isn't telly, for God's sake. And it's just, you know, you have to think on your feet, don't you?
You do.
And that is the whole point.
And it's a bit like learning to drive a car in a way. There are certain things you must do to make it work. And I'll show you afterwards if we have time afterwards. But I'll show you all the little bossy notes I wrote. You don't have to back announce Harriet Cass. Everyone knows who she is. Now you must tell the time. And those are actually, for everyone who starts on today, they are the most difficult.
You made him. You made him. Enough. Enough. Let us allow John the last few minutes and seconds.
Well, that is kind of you, Justin, because I've got to say a few thanks as well, if you'll indulge me. After 5,000 programmes, there are quite a few people to thank. First, you lot, of course, my fellow presenters. You wouldn't believe how competitive they are, honestly, if you're listening. But that's how it is in this business. And in spite of that, it's been wonderful working with them, all of them, down the years. But it's not us who make this programme what it is. It's the producers. They're amazing. They work hideous hours, often all through the night. They don't get paid much, and we get all the praise, but they are the real stars. My huge thanks to all of them, and my apologies if just occasionally I was a teeny weeny bit grumpy. And the boss, Sarah Sands, came new to the BBC a few years ago. We all feared the worst, but she challenged a lot of our assumptions, and we needed that, and I promised I won't mention one of her ideas, the puzzle for today, so I won't. Obviously, there won't be a programme, wouldn't be a programme, if people didn't agree to be interviewed, so thanks to all of them, including the politicians, or at least those of them, the vast majority who still recognise it's important that people in power should be held to account, even if just occasionally we might give them a bit of a hard time. Thanks, of course, to the BBC for tolerating me for so long. There's a lot wrong with it as an organisation. There's a lot wrong with every organisation, and it's facing massive challenges from social media and changing behaviour and all that. But I believe we need the BBC as much now as we ever have done. I simply cannot imagine this country without it. It is an unthinkable thought. And finally, and far more important than anything else, my thanks to you, to the vast numbers who've written over the years, sometimes to give me a pat on the back, often to give me a kick up the backside for getting it wrong or for being out of touch. You're always right. Well, nearly always. I am amazed at the loyalty you have shown this programme. You really are the backbone of our country. You care about our democracy. I know that from all your letters and emails. It's an old-fashioned thing to say, I suppose, but I really do feel that I have got to know you over the decades, and you're decent people. I'm more proud than I can say that you have put up with me for so long. Thank you, all of you. And I do hope you keep listening. Today matters for tomorrow. And if that's a rather corny way to end my years on the programme, well, so be it. And that's it from me and from today, from Justin and me. Thanks to our editors. Good morning.
Let's have a round of applause. I don't see why not. They can do it in Parliament. We can do it here in the studio.
Break all the rules.
Thank you, John. John, thank you so much. Thank you for being here. And thank you on behalf of everyone who's listening, who is treating today as a pretty sad day. And thank you as well to Joel Moores and to Imogen Walford, who put together today's programme behind the scenes. So many people behind the scenes who work so hard on the programme. But from John and from me this morning, goodbye.
Good morning.